essentially 90% of all email users are now captured by about 10 companies. And those 10 companies are really the gatekeepers of the email network. It's actually not difficult to imagine a similar future for Bitcoin, especially now that institutions are joining. I think it's very easy to fall into a trap to believe that because Bitcoin is doing well right now, that if we don't change it, it will continue to do well in perpetuity. And my main point that I'm trying to get across is that
Jameson Lopp is an influential cypherpunk and Bitcoin advocate. He is also the co-founder and chief security officer of Casa, a Bitcoin security provider.
Active in cryptocurrency since 2012, Lopp is dedicated to empowering individuals through self-custody and private key management, embodying the cypherpunk ethos of using cryptography to shift power from authorities to individuals.
If we assume that this is true and that this could be happening, what is it that needs to be changed on the base layer?
Well, I mean, there's a number of improvement proposals out there, but this is kind of what I'm afraid will happen, is that people will keep denying that quantum computing is going to be a threat anytime soon, and then by the time there's sufficient evidence that it is a threat, then it will be too late to save everyone, at least, because...
Hey, Jameson, great to have you on the podcast.
Good to be here. Always happy to talk about Bitcoin.
Nice. Yeah. You recently were in Lugano, I think, and you gave this very interesting speech also on ossification, or it was more or less like a debate that you had with Jimmy Song. But that's something I found particularly interesting. But I've also been following you for quite a while already, obviously, like your awesome web page, you know, lop.net is something that we certainly have to link to because I've been using it a lot myself. And I know many Bitcoin friends who have been referring back to this page all the time. So really cool to have you on the podcast and talk a few things through with you, though. That's certainly great. I had this recent tweet. I think you tweeted it out a few weeks or months even ago, you know, where I found this particularly interesting, where you were kind of tweeting out, the purpose of Bitcoin is to neuter the man. I don't know if you still recall this tweet. I guess you are. So can you elaborate your thoughts regarding this tweet, what you actually meant?
Yeah, I mean, I was just coming up with a catchy way of saying that really the point of Bitcoin, you know, we talk about decentralization a lot, but you can measure decentralization in a number of ways. And really, the most important point of all of the things that we try to do to keep Bitcoin decentralized is, in fact, to keep power decentralized. And so the man is essentially what I think of when you think of like a single entity. You know, it could potentially be a group of people, but, you know, one logical entity, person or persons that coordinate and have so much power over a given system that, you know, essentially they can dictate the course of that system. And so, you know, that's one of the things that we're fighting against with central banks, for example, is that they essentially sit at the top of the food chain of the traditional financial system, and they, you know, can pull the puppet strings and move different levers around really however they want, and the rest of us are beholden to them. So in Bitcoin, it's a lot more complicated to try to understand the balance of power, but, you know, Bitcoin is crypto anarchy. So it is not a democracy. It is not set up in such a way that any given group of people can just come together and decide to, you know, force changes upon the entire ecosystem.
That's interesting. I mean, because I found this tweet so interesting because of, like, I read this, it was a paper a while back, you know, where some researcher were kind of like trying to figure out what Bitcoin is in the end. And they kind of likened it to a sort of new institution that we nowadays have, you know, because they were like saying or arguing as humanity, we have been trying to decentralize power like all along, you know, by coming up with different and new institutions. We had probably the king and the sovereigns back in the day, you know, which power was quite centralized. And we had all these different institutions, like where you kind of try to balance power, you know, with checks and balances. And now Bitcoin can, or that's what the authors of this paper said, it can be neatly integrated into this train of thought or this trail of thoughts, you know, where you have, where we're just trying to build new institutions. And it particularly now, probably as you said, when we liken it to central banks in terms of money, where we kind of try to decentralize and trust minimize the system. So I was wondering, where you were getting at with this tweet, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really like the term institution because that kind of implies more coherence and generally like hierarchy and order and control that is imposed. You know, when it comes to Bitcoin, it's really voluntary interaction. So anyone who cares can contribute in a number of different ways to the system and to, you know, try to give their input to the system and try to, signal to other people and build consensus for doing certain things. But no one sits at the top of a hierarchy, where they can coordinate or collude with a small number of people to then drag the rest of the ecosystem along with them. So, I wouldn't call it an institution. I do think it's an interesting new form of governance or organization, and I've spoken about that in a few different presentations over the years.
Mm. Yeah, also interesting. Yeah, not calling it an institution. I guess like these authors, they were coming at it from like a really like research-driven and academic background, and that's why they were kind of like trying to think about Bitcoin in institutional economics terms, you know, and that's probably why they chose this term. But I would also say probably it's something else. It's not like your typical institution where you have a hierarchy, but exactly, it's evolving, and as you said, it's more like a decentralized network, and that's what's so interesting about it, probably. In that regard, maybe I have this question, you know, because I'm being asked all the time, like, yeah, then people are like, yeah, okay, it makes sense, you know, we're trying to neuter demand, so to say, we're trying to trust minimize the system, but Bitcoin can never be completely trustless in a sense, you know, because you always have humans which are involved, it's a technology after all. And then you hear this argument, like, who controls Bitcoin? Is it not the case that like core developers, for example, really do control Bitcoin after all, because these are the ones who maybe put in the code if there are any changes? Or is that even flawed in the first place, this view?
Well, it's all about checks and balances. So you can certainly think of core developers and protocol level developers, you know, the people who talk about changes to the protocol itself or the implementations of the protocol. You know, they certainly have influence, and you know, they're the ones who are deciding what to build. But there's a lot of checks and balances there. So for one, I had some research I did a few years ago into the Bitcoin Core as a project and understanding, you know, what's the like quality assurance threshold of getting code into Bitcoin Core? And, you know, this was a couple of years ago when I ran the numbers, but it basically came down to like less than 20% of all of the code that people wrote to request that code get merged into the Bitcoin Core project actually made it through the whole gauntlet of review, peer review, and acceptance, and eventually getting the code in. So, point being that first of all, you know, it's hard to even get code changes into the project because they have a really high bar. And even if you do get code changes in, and that generally means like in order to get a code change in, You need to not have any like reasonable objections left that are unresolved. So, you know, anyone who wants to can comment and review your proposed code changes. And if they have reasonable objections that remain unresolved, then you're probably not going to get that code in. But even beyond that, if the Bitcoin Core maintainers became malicious and they pulled in code changes that did not actually have broad consensus, then the balance of power there is that they can't actually force anyone to run that code. So there's no automatic updates or deployment mechanisms for Bitcoin node software. And so due to the fact that just a lot of people are watching these projects, if that happened, somebody would raise an alarm, basically, you know, on mailing lists, on social media, and talking to friends and whatever, and would basically say, you know, don't update your node software because it has this bad change in it. And it's trivial to then, you know, fork off that code base into a different repository if, for example, you believe that the maintainers of the Bitcoin Core project were compromised in some way.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, exactly. I mean, if we spin this thought a little wider, or I would say, I mean, the interesting thing, you said something about you can't force people into something, you know? And I think that's also what I like about Bitcoin. I don't know if you agree. As you said, I mean, you can't force any obligations onto any users because, as I understand it, people don't have to download this newest version that you just, as you described it. So, like, if we, again, compare this to countries, you know, and other, like, traditional institutions, there, if they're, like, as you said, it's a democracy, we have an update in the sense of people vote, and then, like, you have a majority that wins, and you have a minority that doesn't win. Then in the end, everyone has to follow this. And if you disagree, you actually have to go change your place of living. You know, you have to migrate to another country. Whereas in Bitcoin, you don't have to go to another cryptocurrency or something. You can still use Bitcoin itself, but just not upgrade. And I think that's a key point, right?
Yeah. I think a lot of people don't quite understand the concept of crypto anarchy or anarchy in general. Well, first of all, because nation states have done a good job propagandizing the word anarchy so that people think it just means chaos, when of course all it really means is without rulers. It doesn't mean that there are no rules in place. It boggles a lot of people's minds because they're generally not able to think of how a system of rules could work if there's no authority to enforce them. Of course, in Bitcoin, we understand that it works by basically inverting governance on top of its head, so that instead of rules being enforced from the top down, the rules are enforced from the bottom up, with, you know, anyone who runs a node. One way that I like to think of it is, instead of trying to think of governance from a nation state level, if you're trying to understand anarchy, think of how do nation states actually exist at a peer level. So, you know, the nations of the world exist in a state of anarchy with each other. You know, there are groups like the United Nations, but once again, they can't really force other sovereign nations to do things. They can suggest things, you know, they can potentially impose sanctions or whatever, but one of the major aspects of organizations like the United Nations is that they respect the sovereignty of each nation to basically do what they want within their own jurisdiction.
Yeah, exactly. Great observation. That's exactly the case. When I was studying like international relations, that was one of the key findings, or that where it dawned on me that there's no state above any state, you know, or like there's actually a state of anarchy among states. Yep. So that's certainly interesting. Well, I mean, you know, I think a lot of people are sympathizing with this. Also, a lot of Bitcoiner, obviously, when I talk to them, you know, like Bitcoin is this trust minimized system where we don't want to kind of also fumble with it in any way. You know, we don't want to, yeah, mess things up and stuff. So, and that's exactly what they say. Yeah, we have to kind of keep involvement as low as possible, you know. And I think from there, you have a few people who arrive at this, I would say, yeah, goal or just like assumption that you have to ossify the protocol sooner than later, you know, because then obviously everything is set in stone and nothing can be changed. And that way it's even harder to kind of mess with this institution, if I want to call it that, you know, Bitcoin. Yeah. And you have taken, you have this speech, you know, and I think you also published an article that we will link where you we're against ossification. So can you maybe explain what does ossification even mean? And then probably why have you spoken out against it?
Yeah, so ossification is almost like a law of physics when it comes to network protocols. There are many different network protocols that have been around for decades now and have all ossified. And the reason for this is that if we're talking about protocols, we're basically talking about a language. You know, it's a way for computers to communicate with each other to accomplish some specific task. So we've got things like email, the SMTP protocol. We've got more fundamental protocols. There's like seven layers of protocols that actually compose the standard internet networking stack. And pretty much all of those layers are ossified. This is like TCP, IP, Ethernet, so on and so forth. And they ossify because there is no authority that can dictate what the protocol is. Rather, it is, once again, it's a voluntary interaction thing where people run the software that speaks that protocol language. And if we're not speaking the same language to each other, we effectively can't use the protocol. So there's a network effect issue where as the network grows, as more and more people use a specific protocol, the value of that network grows, and also the ability to coordinate changes to that protocol becomes harder and harder. So essentially, if you want to think of it in terms of physics, it's like the mass of the network grows as more people use it. And if you think it's like it's going in a certain direction, then the amount of energy or effort it takes to move, you know, to change the velocity of that thing as the mass grows becomes greater and greater until it's essentially an immovable object because there's too many people and you cannot coordinate amongst all of them without breaking a large swath of the network, which of course would greatly reduce the value of the entire network. So this is going to happen to Bitcoin. It may have already happened. We won't really know until we have a lot of hindsight. And unfortunately, I think the problem that we've seen with a lot of the conversation around ossification is that I think it's very easy to fall into a trap to believe that because Bitcoin is doing well right now, that if we don't change it, it will continue to do well in perpetuity. And my main point that I'm trying to get across is that you can ossify a protocol, but the rest of the world does not ossify. And so new problems will come up, likely problems that are not foreseen. Some of them are foreseen, like the quantum computing stuff that I've talked about recently. But if a new problem comes up that is, you know, potentially a critical threat to the ongoing operation of the network, and you can't actually change the protocol to adapt to that new threat, then you're going to have some problems. And one of the things I talked about a couple of years ago when I was talking about SMTP, because I spent the first decade of my career as an email engineer, email went down a multi-decade long path where it worked really well for several decades, but then in the 1990s, as it hit mass adoption, that is when it hit this inflection point where it became too big to really change the email protocol, but more and more adversarial actors, aka spammers, were joining the email network and causing lots of problems, because email had not been designed with the concept of anti-spam. it had been designed under the assumption that you wanted to guarantee delivery of email messages. And so what happened over the next few decades is that because we couldn't put anti-spam mechanisms directly into the protocol, we layered all of these solutions on top of it, which were all highly centralized and ended up greatly increasing the cost of being able to actually, you know, run a node on the email network, to the point where essentially 90% of all email users are now captured by about 10 companies. And those 10 companies are really the gatekeepers of the email network. And they do things like manage reputation and blacklists and all of this other stuff. And so, you know, it's actually not difficult to imagine a similar future for Bitcoin, especially now that institutions are joining and we're seeing lots of money flow into a small number of centralized custodians. It's a future that I would like to avoid. And it also gets tricky to talk about because if you talk to anybody about email, they're like, oh yeah, I use email all the time. It's great. But if you think of email from a like sovereign communications platform, nobody is actually using the email protocol anymore. They're using trusted third parties that are then using the email protocol in what is now actually a very tiny network of nodes, of people actually running those email servers. So this is kind of the unfortunate thing with in terms of incentives is the same thing could happen with Bitcoin, where Bitcoin could continue becoming worth more and more and more money, even as the network itself centralizes more and more, and we start to lose important properties like permissionlessness and censorship resistance.
Yeah, that's what I found the most interesting point about your presentation, or like your set of arguments that you put forth. You know, you're saying like, okay, the natural course of things is kind of like that things ossify, you know, and then if we know that at some point it will happen anyways, you know, and it's almost kind of fatalistic, you know, that you're like, it's going to happen anyway. So why not argue for it as long as we can? But let's not ossify if there's still some things that need to be changed in order to, as you now described, maybe avoid a similar future for Bitcoin as we have seen, as we now neatly described what happened to email. So That's what I find so interesting and also convincing. So my kind of question would then be, okay, if we assume that this is true and that this could be happening, or we might already be on the path of like similar centralization in Bitcoin, what is it that needs to be changed on the base layer? Like if we just a few things for, without getting too technical, what is the potential that could still be achieved by making a few like elemental changes?
Well, I mean, there's a number of improvement proposals out there. There are things that could greatly increase the security for self-custody wallets with covenants and vaults. There are things that could potentially improve privacy, whether that's something like cross-input signature aggregation or even the ability to more easily create permissionless second layers. I think that's a really big one, is that it's been far too difficult to create permissionless second layers. Like a lot of the second layers out there are actually fairly permissioned. You know, they're like run by federations or organizations that could potentially rug pull you. And, you know, I want to see more experimentation happening in this space, and not necessarily at the base layer, but on other layers where if that layer fails, then it's not going to pose an existential threat to Bitcoin itself. But, you know, we know that there are things coming down the pipeline. Well, this is somewhat controversial as well, but the quantum computing stuff, you know, could potentially become an issue in 10 to 20 years. I think that also just the block space issue and the block size debate is going to come back around again, but in a different vein. And I gave a presentation about that a week ago, though it's not available yet. And essentially, this is related to some of the stuff I was talking about with the institutionalization, where I can foresee a future where almost everyone gets priced out of using the Bitcoin blockchain. And, you know, that may be because we have a proliferation of many different second layers, and people are able to use those more conveniently and cheaply and whatnot. But the issue with second layers is that they can never provide you with the same security model as being on the Bitcoin blockchain in self-custody. So I think this will become somewhat of a philosophical and potentially economic issue around, you know, how affordable do we want it to be to be able to operate with the strongest security model in Bitcoin, which is, you know, self-custody on the main chain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see. But I mean, what is your personal feeling then? Like, because, like, you know, we had this, or at least I'm not really that technical, you know, so I don't follow it that closely, but I feel like, as somebody who's still into Bitcoin and loves to follow these discussions like from afar, you know, at least the last big upgrade we had was like Taproot, I assume, you know, that's what, where I also heard about it. And it felt like there was quite a majority in the end behind it, you know, and this time around, it feels like there's nothing really coming to the surface that it feels like, okay, this could be the next big upgrade. So my question is, as somebody who's following this more closely, are you like optimistic that some of these important changes to make base layer better for base for like layer twos, is something on this on the horizon that could actually be implemented, or are we still kind of just wandering in the wilderness? And it feels like, as you said, this point of ossification could have already be behind us, and we're not going to change anything in the near future.
Yeah, I mean, one of the problems is that there's a number of different opcodes and proposals out there that could be used to achieve somewhat similar things. Though I would say from some of the more recent presentations I've seen, it seems like a lot of the layer two developers tend to agree that opcat as an opcode would be highly beneficial to quite a few different projects and to, you know, layer two builders in general. Now, whether there's a concerted effort to do a soft fork just to activate opcat is one open question. Really, of all of the things going on right now, the one that I think has the greatest potential, but it's also less ready, is Rusty Russell's Great Script Restoration Project. And I believe that would re-enable opcat. It would also re-enable a number of other opcodes that have been disabled for over a decade. And it would do that alongside a kind of safety mechanism framework to ensure that, you know, re-enabling these opcodes doesn't create some, you know, major exploitable condition, or someone could, you know, screw up a lot of the network by essentially creating some sort of script that was like a resource exhaustion or denial of service attack.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, I see. Yeah, opcat, something I've been hearing and floating around for sure. Exactly. I mean, you know, in the end, I'm also thinking, if I try to think this through from an economic lens, sort of, you know, and you brought up incentives as well, you know, I could also imagine that people like Sailor, you know, people who have a lot of Bitcoin miners in the end as well, you know, that they could kind of be incentivized further down the line, because nowadays they've built their business around Bitcoin. You know, it's not that tiny thing anymore. They're really depending on this to work also long term. And I've been hearing such stories, you know, I was in Singapore recently where there were a lot of like Bitcoin layer twos or like at least like they call themselves like this, you know, and there were also a lot of like people who were being tasked by miners to look around what projects could we support. And their argument was like, they know sure well that at some point, you know, the thing that you said with block space could be a problem for them as well, because they don't earn enough with only right. base layer fees, you know, and that's why they could be incentivized again. And maybe Bitcoiners and like true OGs and maybe even cypherpunks don't really like this or don't like to hear this, that it could be again a few people who have a lot of Bitcoin then driving this, but it could be one of the options to kind of educate people like Saylor and these people why it's important to have something like this. And do you see that as a viable route, or would you say that's too dangerous after all? Or
well, you know, Saylor, for example, is pretty strongly in the ossification camp, and if you think about his incentives, as far as we know, he doesn't even hold his own coins, you know, both his personal coins and MicroStrategy. So, from an incentive perspective, this is something I've been talking about a bit recently, which is like one of the reasons why institutionalization of Bitcoin is a potential threat to the evolution of the protocol. Is that the only reason why you would ever want to improve the Bitcoin protocol is to improve the functionality and really the ability for what people who self-custody their Bitcoin can do with it. Whether that's, you know, coming up with new ways of locking and unlocking your coins, or you know, pegging them into other networks where you have completely different functionality and stuff that you can do with them. So, you know, people who are more on the traditional finance side of this, who are just leaving their Bitcoin with trusted third parties, they aren't going to really see any benefit because they're not actually using the Bitcoin protocol. So that's one of the big problems I see with incentives. Miners is an interesting issue of incentives to think of. And I spoke about this in my recent Blockspace Economics talk, where I was basically saying that, you know, if we want to be able to pay for the thermodynamic security of Bitcoin, which is a fancy way of saying pay the miners, and be able to do that sustainably in perpetuity, then we need to ensure that there's always more demand for block space than supply. And this is a really tricky thing, especially as we see more Bitcoin layers come out. Because in from one perspective, certain types of Bitcoin layers are somewhat analogous to doing a block size increase. Because essentially, each Bitcoin layer kind of has its own block space. It may have its own blockchain. It may or may not. But like even if you think about something like Lightning Network, where it doesn't have its own blockchain, the sort of logical end result of pegging your coins into channels on the Lightning Network is that you are greatly reducing the amount of main chain block space that you're using. And so my point there is that new layers coming online and achieving adoption can both decrease the demand for main chain block space, but depending upon how they settle back onto the main chain, they can also increase demand for block space. It just really depends on what the dynamics of that specific layer and the use cases are. For example, I'm expecting Citria's zero-knowledge rollup to actually use a lot of Bitcoin block space. And the main reason for that is because you know, Bitcoin doesn't actually have any native way in the protocol of doing verification of zero-knowledge rollups. So if, for example, over the long term, zero-knowledge rollups like Citria end up proving themselves, then perhaps there could even be a conversation at some point of greatly improving the efficiency of how those rollups get verified on the main chain, which would, you know, reduce block space. But it's basically, it's going to be, I think, its own complicated and volatile dynamic over the coming years and decades, because there's just so many different variables at play and we can't really predict how they're all going to play out.
Great points. I mean, I heard similar points raised by Nick Carter as well, exactly in terms of block space, that it can be positive as well as kind of disadvantages as well, you know. But yeah, I mean, to your points about in institutions, you know, because that's exactly what I thought. And there, now that I think about it, it's also not so bullish from a plebs perspective, because like if you have like institutions who hold maybe paper Bitcoin, you know, they might be incentivized in terms of the price, you know, but I mean, they have no incentive of implementing probably stuff that further down the line strengthens us as plebs and helps us to kind of keep on using Bitcoin in a decentralized way. And that's why that's exactly the problem. We have sort of a collective action problem, and they,
I mean, it's also it's a security issue in the sense that it's creating more systemic risk and fragility. If, you know, a lot of coins go into a small number of hands, and of course they're going to become really high value targets for theft, hacking, or even government seizure. But it's also a governance issue for the future direction of the protocol, because at least in terms of the ETFs, most of those ETFs have language written into them that the ETF issuer essentially has sole discretion at deciding how to treat different forks of the Bitcoin protocol. So, you know, one of the primary votes, if you will, that people have when it comes to Bitcoin forks is buying and selling, essentially trading the different forks to, you know, basically create an economic vote, to move with their feet, if you were, to the network that they prefer. And it's really unclear how that might play out if we did get into some sort of contentious fork scenario.
Yeah, also quite an interesting point, obviously. Yeah, I mean, the ETFs, this is so something that I think further down the line, could be something that shocks Bitcoiner, and they don't think about this like thoroughly enough nowadays, even though, as you said, there's so many variables. But I could see a scenario where they could kind of come around and kind of surprise us in a maybe not so positive way, but let's hope not. I mean, I would like to steer this discussion also real quick to the quantum, you know, risk that you already mentioned, you know, as one of the maybe biggest risks out there that not enough people are talking about. So maybe because two questions, you know, what actually is at risk through quantum computing? Because I keep on hearing people asking this question. They're like, oh, will there be more Bitcoin than these 21 million, you know, or will Bitcoins, can they just be stolen? So what actually is at risk? And then the other question, yeah, maybe I'll go with that one first. Yeah.
Yeah, so quantum computers would not allow you to break the rules of the protocol, but it would, you could say it would violate one of the sort of fundamental properties that we hold dear, which is, you know, not your keys, not your coins. The flip side of that is supposed to be, you know, your keys, only your coins. And so a sufficiently powerful quantum computer, which, as far as we know, does not currently exist, but if you look at the trajectory of advancements in quantum computing, depending upon different estimates you make with the many variables at play in quantum computing, potentially in the next 10 or 20 years, we could get to the point where a quantum computer has enough computational power that it could perform something which is called Shor's algorithm. And Shor's algorithm basically is a way of reducing the complexity of like public private key cryptography, such that you know, if you give a classical computer a public key, the only way that it's going to be able to get the private key is to brute force and try like every possible private key. And this is one of the many reasons why cryptography and Bitcoin is secure, is because it would just take, you know, longer than the life of the universe to crack a private key that matches a given public key. But with a powerful quantum computer, Shor's algorithm can greatly reduce that time so that it actually becomes feasible to find the private key that corresponds to a public key. So, you know, what does that put at risk? Well, it puts at risk all of the pay to public key coins from the first couple of years of Bitcoin. So that would include what is considered to probably be Satoshi's coins. It also puts at risk all of the coins that are in reused addresses. because a lot of the newer types of Bitcoin addresses, you don't put the public key directly on the chain as part of the address. It's actually based off of a hash of the public key. But as soon as you spend those funds, you have to reveal the public key. So suffice to say, if I had a powerful quantum computer, you go to the Bitcoin rich list and you see Binance hot wallet, Bitfinex hot wallet, all of these exchanges that put all of their money into one address. There are several addresses that have hundreds of thousands of Bitcoin in them, and they've been reusing those addresses. So the public keys to those addresses are on the blockchain and publicly available. So, basically we would expect that the incentive would be so great that someone who had a quantum computer would basically start cracking those private keys and stealing the money and doing whatever they felt like with it. And of course, that would cause, widespread market chaos.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's what I would... You mentioned the Satoshi stash, the Satoshi's coins. And there I have the question, maybe it's a new question, but I mean, isn't it inevitable that at some point these will be cracked, if we assume technological progress on quantum computing? Because if we assume that Satoshi is dead even and the keys don't exist anymore, nobody has the keys, they can't even be changed to a new address format, because nobody can swap them. So at some point, somebody will find this treasure trove and unlock it, right?
Well, that's if we don't do anything about it, right? So one of the main points of my talk is that whether we do something or do nothing, then some of Bitcoin's inviolable properties are going to get violated. So either this concept of only your keys, only your coins is going to get violated because a quantum attacker is going to steal them, or we would have to disallow spending from those funds. So if we were to go down the path of rolling out some sort of quantum resistant Bitcoin address locking scheme, and we would then have a migration path, this is one of the reasons why I think we should be talking about it today, even though it's not currently a crisis, is because it would take years, many years for everybody in Bitcoin who's still alive and paying attention to migrate their coins to some new quantum resistant scheme. And so, if we were to go down that path, I think one of the really controversial questions would be, do we set a date, a block height after which you can no longer move your non-quantum resistant coins because we suspect that it would be a high probability that it's actually a quantum attacker who's doing that? Or do we just throw up our hands and say, we're going to let the quantum attackers essentially start mining all of these coins and potentially wreak havoc on the market?
Yeah, such interesting hypothetical thoughts, or at least not as hypothetical as you are describing, but still kind of things we have to think about. I mean, one last point, and I think you already kind of hinted at this, but because that's something I'm hearing a lot, being out of Switzerland, people say, yeah, no problem. Once this is really a pressing problem, we just upgrade, then we find ourselves within the Bitcoin community because it is an actual problem and then we can upgrade. And I'm always like, well, maybe that doesn't work in the end, because that's exactly how Switzerland also works, in a sort of direct democracy sense. That's some argument we keep on hearing against Switzerland. You might be direct democracy, everything is decentralized, but it always takes so long to make upgrades to the political system. And I feel like Bitcoin is exactly the same or even worse, So I think you already hinted at this. Once this is a problem, it might already be too late.
It's funny because I think there's a lot of parallels between the quantum computing debate and the climate change debate. And by that, I mean, we can all see the trends, but what none of us can say for sure is at what point are we all dead? Because if we knew at what point we're all dead, it would be very easy to kind of work backwards from that and say, okay, we need to start implementing the fix before now. So this is kind of what I am afraid will happen with Bitcoin, is that people will keep denying that quantum computing is going to be a threat anytime soon. And then by the time there's sufficient evidence that it is a threat, then it will be too late to save everyone, at least, because actually getting through the whole process of changing Bitcoin, and then once again, related to what we talked about earlier with governance and how it's, you know, it's all voluntary, and there's no way for us to like email every Bitcoin user and say, hey, you better upgrade now or you might lose your money. So this is why I think problems like this need to be solved many, many years before we expect it to become critical.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, this all sounded now maybe a little bit too bleak, or could be taken as really bleak, as a really bleak outlook. So my question is, you really seem to be still active in the Bitcoin space and you still are around. So something must be giving you hope. Otherwise, you probably would have left and said, no, it doesn't make any sense anymore. So what is it, if we want to kind of distill some hope into the listeners and people that are watching this?
Well, yeah. So I think conclusion of my ossification article that I published yesterday was essentially that I see this as a question of, are you optimistic about Bitcoin as a system and the sort of governance and game theory behind it? Or are you pessimistic that it's really fragile? So, you know, I am optimistic that Bitcoin is anti-fragile. And this basically is because there are many of us out there who are talking to each other and we're discussing these issues and we're trying to move forward and continue to improve the protocol and try to mitigate problems that we're foreseeing on the horizon. And I think the people who are more on the ossification side, they're less driven by optimism. They're more driven by fear and pessimism that something's going to go wrong, and therefore it's better for us not to touch anything. But I see, you know, Bitcoin is an open source project, and its strength comes from having a wide diversity of people who are contributing to it and who are looking at it from a number of different perspectives. You know, the more people that you have contributing to a software project, the stronger it is, because it's less and less likely that some sort of exploit or vulnerability is going to go unnoticed. And so one of my fears around ossification is, if we all say, okay, we're not going to touch Bitcoin anymore, then that will result in fewer people paying attention to it, which will decrease the number of eyes and perspectives looking at it and make it more likely that we miss something. We miss some sort of new threat that appears, and that comes in and, you know, becomes critical to the project.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, thanks a lot for sharing this. Yeah. Well, Jamieson, thanks a lot. I think that's pretty much what I wanted to cover with you. I had some more questions in terms of self-custody and the do's and don'ts, but maybe I'll save this up for a future episode, maybe. And yeah, thanks a lot for taking the time. Maybe one last question, you know, given this podcast is called Less Noise, More Signal, any high signal person that comes to mind that we should be talking to in the near future?
I'm really technical, so I pay attention to a lot of the developers rather than the influencers. And if you're not familiar with Brandon Black, I think he goes by Reardon Code on X. He's been making a lot of progress and thinking more about a protocol level improvements and how that can lead to, you know, more permissionless innovation on second layers. And he and I go fairly way back. He worked with me for a few years. We've worked at several of the same companies over the years. And he's a really smart guy. And I think he's also got, you know, a really long-term view and vision for how we keep progressing Bitcoin.
Cool. Yeah, great. It's certainly a name I've never heard. Maybe on X, I've seen a couple of tweets, but it just doesn't ring a bell right now, but certainly somebody to check out. So always nice to also learn new things on that front. So Jamieson, thanks a lot and have a great time. Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
Bye.